You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Ah, spring. Nothing like the world progressing towards summer to inspire your own progress. That's what life's all about. In your career, relationships, and your finances. Let's talk about that last one. With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. So your weekly grocery run can feel even more productive. And that morning coffee can taste like a little victory. And if your credit scores grow, so could your opportunities to get lower rates on loans, like for a new ride or finally having a home to call your own. Sounds like progress, right? With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime feels like progress. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
This is not your typical work podcast.
Sometimes you need to be empathetic. And then there are times that you ask for input, but you don't really give a shit.
Listen to the Ambi Award-nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
Stretch opportunity. What is this, yoga class? Get out of here.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another History of the Great War interview. Today, I'm joined by Yas Huba, the creative director of the World War I game series, which has a new entry coming out in early 2022 called Isonzo. Yas, how's it going today?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. We're still very busy with all the stuff we need to do for the launch. I've been very busy with that. We're a small team, so there's lots to do.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time to come chat with me today. And so one of the things that I found quite remarkable over the years, and I kind of have a personal connection with video games and how it shaped my interest in history over the course of my life, but the video games of the World War I game series, and particularly Verdun and Tannenberg, are really important to a lot of people who, you know, enjoy history. They get pointed to people who want to learn more about the First World War and what it was like. So could you talk a little bit about the earlier games in the series and kind of how the series came about and why you picked some of the topics that maybe that were chosen for the games?
Yeah, so to give somewhat of an overview of where we came from, whenever or when I was little, I visited the Verdun battlefields on a holiday in actually with friends who were amateur archaeologists in the area. That was like in the last century when I was like a 10-year-old. It was very impressive to see those trenches and craters in the forest still around with all sorts of grenades and bones still sticking out of the ground. Very impressive as a little boy. So ever since then, sort of had a fascination with the subject, and I wanted to do something with it. When I was in high school, I did mods for games, Command and Conquer Generals and Medal of Honor. Was part of World War I teams, and then in college when I met the boys from M2H, we decided to make a bigger standalone project, which then grew to be Verdun. And it was just the three of us creating the game for quite a long time. And it grew out into Verdun, which launched into Steam Early Access in 2013, eventually. Yeah, that was still in the early days. And I've always had the idea to do something with World War One and, you know, get all the aspects of World War One into the game, all the fronts. So I think correctly, 2015 we went out of Early Access with Verdun. We extended the game, expanded to the Western Front as much as possible. We started small with just the French and the Germans, because it's named Verdun and we had those factions. And we extended Verdun to be bigger, added Belgians, Americans, etc. And then in 2017, we started with the production of Tannenberg, the Eastern Front. First as in the DLC, but then we decided to make it a standalone game to give it its own game mode, specifically tied into the maneuver warfare. We can go into the details about that later, but there's whole game design based around basically the way of warfare. So that finished in 2019. We did the console versions. Now we're working on game 3, with completely built around the Italian front and the Alpine warfare.
Very cool. So it sounds like the timing of your games releasing around the centenary of the war was more of kind of an accident almost, and not necessarily planned from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember we've been working on Verdun, you know, with the three of us since 2006. And I remember the father of one of the M2A brothers, he said, like, oh, yeah, you're going to be finishing the game when the centennial is there in 2014. I was like, oh, that's so... we'll be done way before that. But of course, the reality of game development, I mean, these games are like normally, you know, DICE, they're with, you know, 300 people in an office. They have like battalion of people working on it. We're like the three of you. So my expectations were wildly optimistic. Still am a bit like that. It was really an accident. We got some benefits from that. The general press being more interested, especially when we did the Christmas truce parts that got also picked up by I think the Daily Mail or something in England. They put it on their front page during Christmas, so that was interesting to get that kind of mainstream attention. That was all through the centennial.
So when you moved to Tannenberg, and you kind of mentioned that you brought it out into its own game because it represented something very different with a different game mode and kind of a very different feel. What were some of the historical things you were kind of highlighting sort of in that game mode?
For Tannenberg specifically. Mm-hmm. For Tannenberg, we wanted to... Okay, take one step back. For then, of course, the trench warfare was very important. So we wanted to do the back and forth struggle. Our games are always very intense. The action is very, very action packed. You don't have to walk for 10 kilometers to get to combat. You're spawn in and you're in the trench next to the enemy, and that's very struggle is very close combat. That's sort of the core DNA of our game. So with Verdun, the back and forth, the trench warfare, the rules we set there were attack, counterattack. So you take the trench, you have to fend off against counterattack. You see this represented in media as well, or in movies, you know, inspiration, the Indiana Jones, where they take the trench and then they have to, then the counterattack comes. So maybe the listeners will probably relate to that. And but also things like Passchendaele, etc. You see this. So that was a clear example that we brought that in. You know, the battles of the Somme and Verdun were very characterized by this kind of horrible attrition of waves of men crashing into each other and then moving the tide of war either one way or the other, so the symmetrical trench warfare. For Tannenberg, then we said, oh, what do we see? What are the most characteristic battles of the Eastern Front? Well, Tannenberg itself with the massive encirclements. It's also a trope in general. There's more space. You see this even in World War II, you know, with the major encirclements of Stalingrad, Kiev, etc., etc. So it's sort of a trope of fighting on the Eastern Front, this massive encirclements, Chemish, the fortress being encircled. So yeah, we really wanted to give that a proper representation. So we built a game mode around that, where you have different sectors and you can encircle. And of course, the landscape itself is way more less linear, endless pine forest or fields or desolate Polish villages, etc., where you have lots of room to maneuver. That's the approach we took there. And for the Italian front, we have a similar approach where we take, okay, Alpine warfare. We know the Italians had great trouble with cutting the wire, you know, pushing up mountains. So the verticality is a big thing there. So we take basically the most characteristic elements of a front and try to distill that into a gameplay that represents that.
Yeah, I really liked the idea of Tannenberg, of bringing the game off of the Western Front, off of the kind of stereotypical battlefields of just, you know, a bunch of guys in trenches that you see in Verdun and a lot of the Western Front. And so moving it to Isonzo also, you know, brings a lot of interesting landscape and interesting opportunities for changes. But where did the idea of moving to the Italian front come from? Was that kind of been the plan for a while? I know you've been trying to get to different theaters. What sort of drew the team to Isonzo, and what do you think makes it really interesting to model in a game and also from history?
Well, I wanted to do the Italian front since we started, because it's the most scenic for sure. And I started in Italy for a bit, and really, you know, the whole scenery is very appealing, especially if you travel there. But yeah, tech-wise, it's hard. The verticality and the way the trenches are sort of carved out into the landscape, you need that justice. You need certain technical requirements, and we didn't quite have that when we finished Verdun. So the Eastern Front was sort of the more the easier option, because it's open forest. So it was less of a tech requirement. And of course, Eastern Front being the sort of larger chunk of the war. Italian Front, with all the respect, of course, for the fighting that went on there, stalemate for pretty much the entirety of, of course, Caporetto and Piave, but other than that, pretty much still operation. So in terms of influence on the outcome of the war, of course, Western Front is the took the priority. It's also the most iconic, also most representative. So yeah, that's why we did Italy after Eastern Front.
I guess I never thought about the fact that as a small development team, when you were making Verdun, the kind of destroyed landscape of the Western Front battlefields actually removes a lot of kind of game development overhead around trees and similar types of structures and other things that you would have to place in the game world.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically trenches, different varieties of trenches, because even in Verdun, we try to make a sort of a diversity of environments. So the flooded fields in Flanders are quite different from Vosges or Picardy. So, you know, maybe for the untrained eye, it all looks the same as a brown drab, but I can see the different shades of that, whether you're in the Vosges mountains in the trees versus the battlefields around Verdun or in Picardy, which have their own characteristic. We try to make a diversity, and that's the same we did for Tannenberg. It's hard because there it's even more generic, and it's like, oh, there's all pine forests and empty fields. How do you portray that accurately? We try to make it as diverse as possible. I mean, our selection of levels, the way we selected the levels in Verdun Tannenberg, also we spread out as much as possible across the entire front, rather than pick the three most famous battles in on the Sommer and in Verdun. So you have Flanders, Vosges, but on the Eastern Front, different biome versus Eastern Media, which is totally different. So we have a sort of try to spread it out as much as possible, and create the most diversity within what we can do, while still be somewhat accurate to the and representing it as accurate as possible. We always try to be as representative as possible, so not cherry pick too much the events. For the Isonzo, however, we are taking a slightly different approach. So where we are representing specific battles and specific dates, and recreating that as accurate as possible.
You can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade, or at least grab an extra latte. After getting a Chime checking account with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, no minimum balance requirements, and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime. Feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did, because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories.
Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. And about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today. And join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
So these games, you know, bring in a lot of history, and that's one of the reasons I know that I'm sure a lot of your fans really like that. So what is kind of the process of going from, you have these historical events, you know, how are you researching, how are you picking out things that you want to bring into the game that you think really represent? So on the Isonzo, you know, what kind of pieces do you feel you have to bring into the game to kind of capture the feel and the history of those events?
Yeah, there's not a lot of material available on the Italian front to begin with. There's only a handful of English books, unfortunately. And or there are, you know, small footnotes in bigger documentaries or it's like, okay, they fight here. And then, you know, they talk about fighting on the Italian front. They talk about, oh, the Italians tried to get past the Isonzo 11 times. But then they show footage of Alpine, you know, where they lift mm-hmm. cannons up the highest peaks, which is not really representative of the Italian front, to my understanding, and also to the facts, where mm-hmm. 90% of the casualties and attacks were done in the lower zone, so near the Adriatic coast. So that area was took a lot of the focus. And as I said before, or my intent is to at least be as representative as possible for the conflict as a whole and not cherry pick. So we're not, you know, taking the coolest looking mountains and then base the entire game around that. But the Carso being sort of most boring looking part of the Italian front will get the main highlight because that's where the action happens. So yeah, there's within game development, there's and in the media in general, you have you as the creator have the ability to shed light or not on certain aspects. So it's always hard because it's always a tight balance because you on one hand you do want to do justice by it, but the reality is often quite boring. You know, if you were to do real justice by the Western Front, 90% of the fighting was done in, you know, a ditch in the middle of a farm field with nothing around it. If you drive north to Paris, just, you know, it's just endless fields of crops, and that's where the fighting took place in Picardy. So that's it. You have your trench in the middle of mud. That's 90% of it. So you know, you have to sort of balance that with the reality versus gameplay and aesthetics. So that's a tight balance. Luckily in Italy, it's slightly easier to do that because, you know, even on the Carso, you have say Monte Sabotino, which is we buried not too long ago. We did a tour on the Italian front, and you have the giant bridge there. It's also featured in the trailer, the big river. Those are luckily also there in that region. So in that way, you have to cherry pick a bit within the parameters that we set for ourselves.
I end up in a lot of conversations with people around video games and how they represent history and things like that. And my favorite example is always that if you were to make a realistic Western Front game, there would be a lot of players with like sacks full of grenades, and nobody likes a video game where there's people with like 20 grenades that they can throw at you because that's very annoying.
Yeah. We had some classes in Verdun, which actually had the only thing you got was like a shovel and six grenades. So and people like that. It's so atypical. I like being a grenadier, even in, say, Call of Duty or something. Probably get a lot of hate for this, but even in a playtest, it's also I like to be the grenadier. I'm not a very skilled FPS player. Yeah, I mean, if you were to be really purist about being as accurate as possible, you know, 90% of the time would be wading, digging latrines, and you know that would be the 90%, and you know 10% is action. Specifically, trench warfare by definition is in action.
I always wonder when people are kind of embarking on these kind of entertainment creation things like video games or these games specifically, where you know they are hewing closer to history. Like when you are sort of researching and designing, do you feel any kind of like responsibility to represent history accurately or correctly, or do you feel any responsibility for kind of what people are taking away from the game that you're creating?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Especially with this, because I feel like in some ways I'm breaking new grounds with the Eternal Frontiers. I can create, I've basically the power to create the way people view the Eternal Front in popular culture, because there's, I don't think there's any, there's no blockbusters on the Eternal Front. I think there was maybe a Hemingway, a movie about Hemingway in a way back when, and there's a couple of movies in from the 70s and a movie set in the High Alps, but yeah, that's about it. So, and of course, there's Battlefield 1, which it did their thing. We can go into detail about how they did that, but yeah, in a way, I'm I have to decide what gets highlighted. So, yeah, it was kind of it took a long time picking the locations we did. Went over it, books, and so yeah, that does put a little bit of weight for the Western Front, and the Eastern Front was kind of is easier because there's more material. It's clear what the major battles were versus the minor battles. Yeah, for the Eternal Front, that's not as clear. There's a lot of mountains, obviously, but with lots of similar names. There've been names in three different languages, sometimes in some cases, Slovenian, German, and Italian, and they're all mixed. It's kind of fuzzy in a lot of ways. And also, especially the battles in the higher Alps, they're by and large done by a very small amount of troops. Even getting up there is just hard. You can imagine like transporting 100,000 troops to kilometer high. That's just not going to happen. So in that way, we also try to, you know, pick locations that are representative but also nice looking. So there's a balance there. Took me months to make a decision about that. The producer said, "Yeah, we need to make a decision now. We need to start production." Luckily, to get some help from reenactors, and yeah, there's some help from the community as well, especially when it comes to details. But yeah, this was kind of on my plate. I'm pretty sure some people say no, but this is actually a better sure. You know, in history, and that's been the case since we started Verdun, is people expect us to be accurate. Even if we want, like, we wouldn't have gotten away with it. Like, if we wanted to make some Call of Duty semi-fantasy stuff, that, yeah, people just expect us to be realistic. Especially if you're breaking new grounds and you are somewhat claiming to be accurate, then people expect you to go all the way with it. We get comments of anecdotally of button on the uniform wasn't just not high enough, or the medal was not worn here but it's here instead. Like, it's that level of detail we're getting feedback on. So typically indicator that you're doing something right is not like, oh, you shouldn't have a pink uniform, but
yeah, it's that's interesting. It's like a challenge of balancing the requirements of an audience that is deeply interested and deeply passionate about the history with the fact that, again, this is a video game and there are finite amounts of things that you can do as a development team when creating that game.
Yeah, exactly. It's over always a budget. We're a small team, so we can only do so much. But then again, a lot of our artist, for instance, really who does the uniforms himself, also really a World War One geek. So he's, you know, he also wants the same thing, and a lot of people in the team have the same feeling as well. So it's not just me constantly saying, "Oh, this needs to be more accurate." It's kind of organic to a lot of these projects.
Yeah, and having team members with at least a solid interest in a lot of those topics probably just makes conversations a lot easier around what you're doing and what you're going for in the design.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't have a corporate overlord per se. So it's like, for instance, in Battlefield, they had to make a lot of decisions, you know, based on, oh, we're going to monetize a certain, we have to be, you know, the marketing material has certain requirements. So in that way, we're kind of liberating because we're independent. So that helps.
You mentioned earlier, we were talking just briefly about sort of classes in your game. And one of the things I was curious about for Asanzo is, you know, there's a lot of sort of specialized troops that are there on the Italian front, especially, you know, you're talking about those very high mountains and the small number of troops that are involved in that. So are you guys modeling that in your game, and sort of how are you approaching the specialized nature of some of the troops involved?
Yeah, we've taken a bit of a different approach with Asanzo versus Verdun Tannenberg. Verdun Tannenberg had really a class system, which are pretty much the same for both games. you have this specific squad, and they had this type, and within the squad there were roles. With Isonzo, we're making the class system a bit more flexible, so you have classes you can pick. You don't necessarily need to be in a squad, specific squad. So that just makes the experience a bit more accessible. We found that. Isonzo is basically an improvement on almost all aspects of the game. The series are improved with this. This is one of those points. I think the freer class system helps with that. That said, we do have officer. We have class limits also. It's not like you can have 20 officers. There's only 2 officers available per side, so that they can influence the battle. Then mountaineers are a big thing. So you have a specifically dedicated slot to a mountaineer. Outlined it in a blog recently, where we found the mountaineer had to be represented somehow. First of all, visually, they had specialist mountain troops, like the Alpini troops, had to have their own class. So they move quicker around the terrain. They're more trained to alpine warfare. we introduced a vaulting system where you can climb over stuff. They do that faster. There's the different abilities or perks, so to speak, that you can select, and you can specialize it even more. So moving faster. They also do reconnaissance, climbing faster. They have lighter equipment. That's the extent of the mountaineer class. Probably forgetting something now, but and then there's the assault troops with specialized equipment. Engineers are a big thing, especially as I mentioned in the beginning, the whole dynamic with the wire, which we wanted to put in Verdun, and the whole thing of cutting the wire, repairing it. We double down on it in this game. So each line has a layer of wire, which I can in front of each sector. So you basically progress through a map across to the top of a mountain, typically. And then each defensive line is basically a wire a belt in front of it, which has certain holes in it, which are vulnerable in it that can be repaired or cut or destroyed, depending on what the players do. So engineers can blow it up, but others can only cut it, and engineers can only repair it. So you create this interesting dynamic of repairing the wire and trying to get through it.
Interesting. I could definitely see, in my limited knowledge of video game development, of why that would be a feature you would want to have, and also maybe why it would get cut from the other games if you didn't have a big enough team.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just the whole how you synchronize these things. Uh-huh. And so we have a whole new building system where you can actually build your own sets of wire freely. So this is on top of the wire belt system that we have. So we have fixed wire belts, which is certain slots in it. But then there's also players can also build their own sandbags, etc. So we've extended that simply because in trench warfare, you can. Construction was a big thing, building your own little fortification. Of course, it's all sort of a distillation of what would happen in real life, or that building your own machine gun nest takes quite a long time, but here it's done in a much shorter compact.
I've been following this game for a little bit on social media and stuff, so I've seen some of your marketing materials. I am led to understand that mustaches on characters are a big part of this game. Can you talk about the importance of the mustache on players in this game?
Yeah, it started off as we wanted to do something with the character customization and the different troops. In Verdun Tannenbergrocks, we have the squads, so, and then you level the squads, and then within that you had the customization progression. In Eternal Front, uniform progression is not as drastic as on the French with their red coats versus later war, totally different pico haubes. It's a bit more fudged, especially Austro-Hungarians. They were just ragtag force of whatever they could find a true on uniform mixtures, etc. So Italian didn't change that much, slightly different helmets. But, since they joined in a bit later, their progression is, of course, a bit more capped. So in that way, we took the liberty of making the customization system a bit more flexible. So we could do that with this game. So the mustaches are a part of that. So it's like we went full out on this. There's like I think in total about 50 mustaches, and we're all based them on historical figures. So you know, Konrad von Hötzendorf, different shape. They all have unique shapes. Yeah, that's cool, and it's also allows us to tell a bit about history. It's not just random shapes. It's also a way of like, oh, this German general you never heard of perhaps before, and it has a reference in the game.
This person you never heard of had an amazing mustache, and now you will learn about them.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm all about, you know, making sure that the features that we do put in have some kind of historical or pull in some, at least some reference to a historical thing. So this is another opportunity to do exactly that.
I think it's an example of a really fun way to introduce more history, but also make it, you know, fun and interesting to kind of bring it in there. In that's how you get people interested in these events, and that's when they go off and do more research.
Yeah. It's a bit goofy when you think or when you see it, and you see the mustache in the video we made. It's like sort of swapping out, and they get weirder. But of course, there were a lot of different facial hairs at the time, and you can see that on the photos of all the officers, and so it was really a thing then. So yeah.
So thank you so much for coming here and chatting with me about Isonzo and kind of the past and I guess future at this point of the World War One game series. It's been a great talk, and also again, I think I mentioned this at the beginning, but I do know a lot of people who are really interested in the First World War play these games and have spoken with me about them and how they have shaped or changed their interest in the First World War. So, you know, good job, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I like